When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So Jeff, we're not alone.
You've invited somebody to the chatteroo.
I have. I hope that's okay.
Of course.
So we have my friend and the absolutely brilliant climate scientist, Emily Shuckburgh, who is director of Cambridge Zero, which is an ambitious initiative of Cambridge University around climate science. She also worked at the British Antarctic Survey, and I first met her on a climate march in 2009, I think. Is that right?
It was 2009, it was, yes.
And she has been very kind enough to give up some time to talk to us. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no, it's always a pleasure.
I feel like you're slumming it with us a little bit because you wrote a book with the king.
I did.
And, how does that work? Do you type and he dictates, or do you dictate and he types?
Actually, there was another author as well, Tony Juniper.
Oh, so he did the typing.
No, actually, you know what? The king was really involved. So it wasn't, you know, everyone always assumes that we wrote it and he just signed off with it. But, you know, this is a topic that he's hugely knowledgeable about. So he was really involved in every aspect of the book.
And are there any characters from the Old Man of Loch Nagar in the book?
No, but the book is a ladybird book.
Yes.
And so there's text and pictures, you know, that in the traditional ladybird style. And so what I'm, you know, without sharing competences that I'm probably not supposed to share, but one of my distinct memories was there's a section of the book that talks about past climate change, ice, you know, where we've moved in and out of ice ages. And the picture associated with that is of some, you know, Neanderthal attacking a woolly mammoth. And one of the comments from the king was that the woolly mammoth looked a bit passive. And so the artist had to go back and make the woolly mammoth look a bit more.
You need your woolly mammoths being aggressive. I mean, they're not passive. They're not passive aggressive. They're just aggressive. Now, the reason we're having you on, Emily, is Polly, it's nice to see you, but also because we have just come off a year which has broken all records, and not in a good way, for temperature. And I actually thought this before Christmas. I thought it would be good to talk to you just about the significance of this, because it kind of was covered a little bit this week, but obviously there's lots of other news around. So just to start with, tell us sort of your verdict on the 2023 kind of global temperatures as you would see it as a climate scientist.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a climate science perspective, you can probably sum it up in one word, which is that it was crazy. I mean, it was ridiculously hot. The numbers that have been coming in over the last week, when we've done, you know, there's been an assessment of the year, is that it was about 1.45, maybe 1.46 degrees centigrade above the pre-industrial period, so above 1850 to 1900, by a long way, the warmest year on record. And in part, that's because of some of the natural changes, which perhaps we can come on to talk about, but predominantly that's because of human-induced climate change.
Can I just say, Jeff, centigrade?
Well, I was going to say centigrade.
Jeff and I have been having a long-running row, Emily, about centigrade versus Celsius. I'm sorry.
Should be Celsius.
I'm with you.
I just think centigrade is this silly made-up word which denies Anders Celsius his moment of glory. Really,
you know what? Even as I was saying centigrade, I was thinking I should really say Celsius.
Oh, sorry, I sort of channeled my centigrade beams into your head. Anyway.
I was going to ask, is there any sense in this, I guess the cliche is turning the tanker around, is it that we're not seeing the results of efforts yet, but it will start to get better?
Well, which efforts? I mean, the problem is we're not making very many.
Well, I know we're not making it, and I know it falls vastly short of what it needs to be. But Ed just came back from COP, and you, in some ways, were quite encouraged by some of the things.
I mean, that is a good. Maybe there's another way of asking that question, Emily, which is, if, let's say, global emissions start to fall, maybe you should say something about the rate of increase that we're seeing, because as I understand it, the rate of increase is significantly greater. But if emissions started to fall, would that slow the rate of increase?
Well, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves. I mean, of course, everything connects together. So, you know, the temperatures respond to the amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. If you look, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is at a record level. So it's last year was 419 parts per million in the atmosphere. And if you go back to those pre-industrial levels, it wasn't 419. It was more like 280 parts per million, or maybe even a bit less. So, you know, that's why we've got such high temperatures, because we've got such huge amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we're adding even more to the atmosphere every year.
So it's not a question of it's getting worse before it's getting better. It's getting worse, and it'll probably keep getting worse.
Depends what happens. Depends what we do, doesn't it? Just say something about the scale of the increase. You said crazy.
Yep.
And then a little bit about the why, because there are other effects going on here, including El Nino, aren't there?
Yeah. So, you know, let's say a few more things about 2023. It was the first time on record that every day of the year, in terms of the global average, exceeded 1 degree Celsius. Let's say Celsius, 1 degree Celsius above those pre-industrial levels. Almost half the days of the year, 50% of the days, were more than 1.5 degrees Celsius warmer than those pre-industrial levels. And in fact, 2 days in November were more than 2 degrees Celsius warmer. So it really was incredibly hot and incredibly close to that 1.5 degree level that we're all concerned about and was written into the Paris Agreement as the level we want to avoid. Now, just in a single year or a single day or a single month, exceeding 1.5 degrees doesn't breach what was generally conceived of being the Paris Agreement threshold. But in terms of where we are, taking into account those daily, monthly, yearly variations, it's estimated that in that kind of longer term picture, we're at about 1.25 degrees Celsius of warming. So that's the number to compare with the 1.5, but we're still getting horribly, horribly close to that threshold. So that's the kind of the status of where we are. Some of the reasons why this last year was particularly hot, and indeed, actually, we anticipate that next year or this coming year, the one that we're in now, 2024, will be even hotter, is because there's this natural cycle that occurs that many people will have heard of called El Nino. And El Nino means that in some years, it's much hotter as a global average than in the opposite phase of that cycle, which is called La Nina. And that means that you know, when in an El Nino year, you typically would have somewhere up to about 0.2 degrees Celsius additional warming from that natural phenomenon. So you do get warmer years in those instances, and that's a natural process. And that's why I say that in terms of the longer term average, we're more on that sort of 1.25 degrees Celsius zone at the moment.
And can we tell, because in the last El Nino, the last record global temperature, as I understand it, was 2016, and that was also an El Nino. Can we tell, is there a way of separating out the climate effect and the...
So that's what I said. So imagine having a straight line going upwards and then wiggles on top of that straight line.
Yeah.
Then the El Nino bit cycle is the wiggles, and a wiggle going up in the last El Nino didn't go up as high as it is in this El Nino because it's on top of that, you know, steep hill going upwards. And as I say, it's about 0.2 degrees Celsius is the difference that it makes. So it's not a huge difference, but it's significant. And actually, the other thing that's worth bearing in mind about this is that you might remember there was a period in about a decade ago, or maybe slightly less, when people's particularly Nigel Lawson used to, and the Daily Mail used to say, "Oh, climate change has stopped, and there's been a hiatus, and it's, you know, this is all nonsense." And that's, you know, an effect. We will, after we've had this warmer period, we will go into a slightly cooler period as part of that natural cycle. And we absolutely should not think that that means that climate change has stopped. It just means that we're part of this cycle. And the number to be looking at is that 1.25 number, because that's the one that's most important.
And can we tell what the kind of acceleration effects are? I mean, one of the things I saw on the BBC report about this was that we're exceeding the global average, I think, for 1990 to 2020 as well. So... does it seem like it's getting faster, the rise in warming, or do we not know that yet?
I wouldn't want to actually say that, because it's quite difficult to separate out those features. But what is definitely the case is that the risk of extreme events, which is the things that are most impactful, so the risk of you know, severe heat waves, or the risks of floods, or the risks of wildfires, and etc. In a sense, the global average temperature is a really useful single indicator, but it's not the thing that's most impactful. And those extreme events go up; the risk of those goes up faster than the risk of the average conditions.
And we're
seeing that playing out around the world, right? We've seen in the last couple, you know, the last couple of years, it seems like pretty much every day somewhere around the world there's yet more of some devastating extreme weather condition occurring.
And just to sort of clarify this, is this what is predicted by your model, this temperature rise, by the modelling? Is it hot? People seem to say, I think this is at the top end of the modelling. Does it suggest something unexpected is going on? I mean, I don't, beyond the kind of obvious, effects of more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and greenhouse gases. I mean, what's your sense about that?
So my sense is that actually the modelling has been pretty consistently accurate, if I'm perfectly honest, in terms of our projections and what's actually played out in terms of the temperatures. The models themselves don't predict exactly some of these, you know, natural ups and downs. They predict that long-term pathway, and they've been pretty accurate. The thing that's not included in the models, and we know it's not included in the models, which is probably the most concerning aspect of starting to move towards these higher temperatures, is that we know there are many potential tipping points in the climate system, and generally the physical processes that are associated with those tipping points are not properly included in the models. And so that's the aspect that's probably of most concern in terms of the weaknesses, if you like, of the models in terms of predicting the future.
Can you tell us a bit more about those tipping points?
Yeah, so So the one that's probably most at risk are coral reefs. And so as we move above 1.5 degrees of warming, it's almost certain that the vast majority of the warm water coral reefs around the world will be severely affected. And there's a real concern that they might pass a tipping point. And that in itself would be devastating for the coral reefs, but that has huge global implications. So there's something like 500 million people who directly or indirectly, their livelihoods depend on those coral reefs. So it's a, you know, it is a really major concern. So that's one, but probably the closest to being a really major tipping point. The other, you know, another example of a tipping point, which is something that I've studied a lot, are the ice sheets covering Greenland and West Antarctica. And that's an instance where we know when the world has been, you know, not much more warmer than it is today. So if you go back into the, actually our woolly mammoth eras, so that sort of, you know, go back into the distant past, the world has been in different climate states. Those different climate states have been not because of human activities, obviously, but because of changes in the orbit of the Earth about the sun. But if you go back to the last time the Earth was as warm as it is today, which is about 125,000 years ago, sea levels were much, much higher than they are today. So about 6 to 10 meters higher than they are today. And that was because those ice sheets in the polar regions, Greenland and West Antarctica, weren't intact. So we got good evidence from the past that as you warm the world up, those ice sheets pass a tipping point. And so that's, you know, another concern. And then there's, you know, then there's a host of other ones in terms of the overturning circulation of the ocean, in terms of the Amazon rainforest, in terms of the permafrost and potential methane release from the permafrost in the Arctic and so forth. And those are probably the biggest concerns, because once those have been set in train, they're tipping points for a reason, because you can't easily turn them back again.
Ed mentioned before that you had led the study group on the Antarctic, is that right?
I worked at the British Antarctic Survey, yes.
So how long were you there for?
For a decade. I was leading the oceans group, the polar oceans group, so we were studying particularly the ocean around Antarctica. And so British Antarctic Survey is based in, it's headquartered in Cambridge, but then we'd undertake field research in Antarctica, or in my case, it was on the ship in the Southern Ocean. And so some of the things that we were looking at was that interaction between the warming oceans around Antarctica and the integrity of the sea ice and also the ice sheets. Because in Antarctica, the ice sheets are predominantly melting from below as the warm water from the ocean gets underneath the ice sheet and melts it from underneath.
What difference does it make to you, like as a scientist? Obviously, mm-hmm. you're used to data, empirical data. What difference does it make to you personally when you see it with your own eyes?
Oh, you know, it's hugely important to see those sort of things. Anybody who's undertaking any scientific research, if you just sit at a computer and model it, you don't get the real understanding compared to if you're actually, actually visibly looking at some of the critical processes. And actually, in terms of one of the most crucial aspects to understand is the scientific uncertainty on some of the data. And you can only really understand that if you're actually taking part of actually taking the measurements. So there's a real thing about if you're an oceanographer, you have to get your feet wet.
And talk to us a little bit about what's happening with the oceans and Antarctic sea ice.
Oh, well, yes, actually, I mean, honestly, the oceans and the ice have also been crazy, I think that is the right word, unfortunately, this last year. So sea surface temperatures have been at absolute record highs globally, and particularly actually in the North Atlantic, have been extremely, extremely high, which is of real concern. And that probably is something that wasn't entirely predicted. We don't really quite understand why they've been so high. And Antarctic sea ice has been exceptionally low. It's actually, right at the moment, it's slightly recovered because it goes through an annual cycle of melt and recovery and so forth. And compared to how it was in the second half, or well, actually through most of last year, where it was really extremely low, it's not quite as low as it was. Again, not a full understanding of why it was so off the scale this year in terms of the amount of melt, but it's thought probably is due to the interaction with the warming ocean waters, the upper layers of the Southern Ocean being warmer, and that's been the cause of that really substantial melt in Antarctica. And it's significant because we've seen huge melt in the Arctic in terms of sea ice over recent decades, but that hadn't been the case so much in Antarctica. So the fact that, you know, Antarctica really seems to have slipped into a different regime this year is really significant.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If it's not a stupid question, I think the answer is probably fairly clear. But how should policymakers sort of, you know, react to this?
Yeah. So normally I'm usually quite optimistic about all these things, but this last year, honestly, it's kind of pulled out even my, you know, last elements of optimism, if I'm perfectly honest. I mean, it is, honestly, it is really bad state that, you know, what I've just been describing about us coming close to passing tipping points. I've been trying to do my best as a scientist to communicate this to whoever, whether it's policymakers or whether it's the wider public for a long time. We start, you know, that was part of the reason why I wrote the Ladybird book with the King. I feel like I and thousands of other scientists around the world have been trying for such a long time to articulate the risk and the threat, and it's just playing out. And so, to be honest, from a scientist's perspective, it's pretty devastating. But I honestly, I don't know what else we as scientists can do. I know what policymakers need to do. They need to act, and that needs to happen at a international level, where you were at COP28, Ed. I mean, there was kind of incremental progress, but nothing like the level that's required. But it also needs to happen at a national level. And, you know, sadly, we just seem to have lost that leadership position in the UK over recent years. And it needs to happen all the way down to a local level and organizational level and an individual level. You know, people, whatever workplace you're in, your workplace needs to be responding to the climate challenge. As individuals, we need to be looking at our diet or at our modes of transport, or at the ways that we heat our homes. So it's at every single level that things need to be done differently. Otherwise, we're just not going to have a world that's fit to be inhabitable. I tell you, I've got a postdoc at the moment who's been undertaking some research over the last couple of months looking at identifying which regions of the world in the near future will be uninhabitable because the temperature and humidity levels will have exceeded the level that is physiologically capable of supporting human life. That's how bad it is. It's crazy. Crazy, crazy. That's my word to describe it all. Crazy.
And have you ever tried to make sense of that craziness? Because surely when you're sat having a conversation with people, you're able to impress through your expertise the need for urgent action. Have you got any thoughts on the gap between the reception you get when you give people this information and then the subsequent inaction?
Not really. I mean, maybe Ed can help us out with why. I mean, I think people don't want to believe it and so don't. I think it's just plain straight denial. I tell you, sorry to be depressing, but I am a bit in a depressed mood about all of this at the moment. Before Christmas, I was with my daughters watching the latest David Attenborough series, that amazing Planet Earth. And my 10-year-old, after watching it, was very sad. And she said to me, "Mummy, I don't see the point in living." And I was like, oh, my goodness me, I've got some kind of mental health crisis going on here. But fortunately, she didn't mean it personally. She went on to describe that what she was saying was she didn't see the point in humanity when, as a species, you know, we're treating the world so badly. What is the point in us being on the planet if all we're doing is destroying it, which is, you know, pretty mature thing, actually, for a 10-year-old to say, but also pretty devastating, right? So, you know, and I do kind of feel it's that, right? We know full well what we are doing to the world. We know full well what the risks are. The science has been there for 30, 40 years now. And the you know, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change couldn't have been clearer in its report last year, when it said that there is a rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a sustainable and livable future for all. A rapidly closing window of opportunity, that is precisely what it is, and it's precisely what the world is not responding to. I honestly don't know what more I can do as a scientist to try and make that clear.
And, okay, I it's hard to sort of create any optimism out of this, and I don't want to falsely do that, and it's good that you've been honest with us. Just going back to what we said a lot earlier, I mean, if the world manages to sort of, as they say, bend the curve and start to reduce global emissions, I mean, that is clearly the first and most important step. I mean, it's not enough on its own, because they've got to be reduced and reduced substantially. I mean, presumably, you know, 1.5, nobody should give up on 1.5, but it's obviously incredibly challenging. But, you know, every extra 0.1 of a degree or 0.01 of a degree means things are worse, doesn't it? And so therefore, you know, we should, and I think, you know, lots of people have made this point. I mean, yeah, I mean, because we can't give up. And I'm not
I'm saying we absolutely can't give up, because if we do give up, then that goes to my daughter's point of what's the point in humanity, right? So we really give up on everything if we give up. So IPCC was also really clear that there are low cost, feasible solutions that exist today that are not being implemented. So, you know, it is not at all impossible. We could be implementing those low cost, feasible solutions now. We're not doing that, but we could be. And so we're not beyond the stage at which it's possible to turn this whole juggernaut around. We really could be creating a better future for all, that sustainable and livable future for all, if only we put in place concerted action. And there are many, I've talked about tipping points in the climate system, but there are also many tipping points in the response system, if you like, that we could also be enacting. And some of them we've already seen happen. So the uptake of solar energy around the world has been vastly
including in the UK last year.
Including in the UK.
I mean, households. I mean, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, exactly. So that's a positive tipping point. We might be seeing a similar positive tipping point in terms of electric vehicles and battery technologies. So if we can enact those positive tipping points in terms of technology, innovation, and the changes that we make to our lifestyles in response, then we can make rapid change in the right direction. And so what seems like impossible actually can be turned around very rapidly if we manage to tip some of those elements. Now, it's very difficult to tip those elements on technology or on the way in which we live our lives if we don't have the appropriate supporting policy framework. There's a lot that policy can do to create conditions to enable those tipping points, societal tipping points or economic tipping points or technological tipping points. And that's where we really need to have a concerted, coordinated national and international effort.
What sort of things would you like to say?
Well, at a national level, I think it's very clear that Ed's better to comment on this than me in many ways, but it's very clear that we know the sort of things that need to be done at the national level. And Ed is not approving new oil and gas licenses in the North Sea. It's about putting in place the infrastructure, and that includes the training for jobs of the future for energy systems that is dependent on our own homegrown renewable energy rather than importing carbon intensive energy from overseas. Just doing that in itself would make a major difference to our UK response to climate change.
I'm thinking quite a lot about your sort of point about, well, why hasn't it happened? And obviously there's lots of reasons and there's political interests and each country's got its own the thing about climate is it's the ultimate challenge to politics, isn't it? Because it's these are long-term impacts. I mean, they're short-term impacts too, but they're most importantly long-term impacts, and politics is constrained by short-term cycles. I'm not making excuses, but just explanation. I think sort of one of the things that's interesting to me, though, and I don't know whether this accords with what you think, is it's not like the world isn't doing anything. I mean, the world is doing some things. It's just, and so some of the kind of, some of the worst kind of potential, some of the higher temperatures, the sort of 4 or 5 degrees, now look unlikely. That's not meant as a consolation, but I think it's the truth. But the point is that it's just the world is so way short of what the science demands, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've just been talking about some of the things that have happened in terms of solar energy and battery technology and so forth. So, no, it's absolutely not the case that the world hasn't done anything. And just the very fact that we've got a global agreement to keep temperatures well below 2 degrees with an ambition to keep them below 1.5 degrees. I mean, that is, hugely positive, but it's just not translating fast enough through to what's required in terms of the climate system itself. That's the problem.
Something I wanted to ask you about is, do you still come across people, amateur scientists? So, for example, yesterday I was reading the magazine that comes with a paper on a Saturday, and they send two people with opposing points of view out for dinner to see if they can find some common ground. And they had somebody who understands the severity and the urgency of the climate crisis, and then some guy who isn't a scientist, but, likes to dabble in his spare time, and he's done his own modelling. Do you come across people like that?
Yes. I mean, I guess so that sort of real climate skepticism with having amateur scientists, or actually on occasions not even amateur scientists, really trying to deny the science of climate change, that if I roll back 15 years ago, in fact, actually, when we were doing that climate march in 2009, Ed, there really was quite a lot of that. And I used to spend an awful lot of my time. It was a bit like, you know, as a university lecturer marking some students really awful, awful assignment and trying to find exactly where all the errors are. I mean, it's really quite soul destroying to do that. And to have to go in and try and explain why they've actually misunderstood some fundamental part of the science. That doesn't really happen so much any longer. I've not had, I mean, I'm sure that there are, you know, people who come up with their wacky theories as to why we've got, you know, tens of thousands of scientists around the world have got it wrong, but they don't really have the same traction as they once did, unfortunately, because the evidence is just so overwhelmingly strong from multiple different directions. We have climate models that tell us what's happening now and into the future. We have literally millions of observations across all different parts of the climate system. So it's very difficult to try to come up with some amazing alternative hypothesis as to why, actually, despite us putting large amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere each year and them being at record highs, and that being, you know, well understood science in terms of how that would result in higher temperatures, that somehow magically there's some other cause of the increase in temperatures. I mean, it's just not plausible at this stage. So for the most part, I'm sure that there are some people who, you know, have their wacky theories. That's true in every aspect of life, isn't it? But for the most part, they don't really have the traction any longer that they once did.
Well, maybe then, you know, this is a conversation where we in some ways have struggled to find very much optimism. Maybe there is a slight cause for optimism. No,
I think that's true. But and so maybe I'm being too hard on the scientific community, because the fact that we've got to that stage where there isn't, at least in this country, actually, I have to say it's not necessarily true everywhere around the world. I think there's still quite large amounts of scepticism in some parts of the United States. But at least in this country, you don't really see scepticism associated with the science any longer.
Well, look, Emily, it's been a very sobering conversation, but also a very important conversation. The fight goes on. You're doing incredibly important work. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Well, that was a hard conversation.
Yeah, it was a hard conversation. I mean, in a way, it's very sobering to hear it from a sober scientist, isn't it?
Yeah, and just imagine how frustrating it is to be dealing with evidence day in, day out like that, and the stark reality of the situation, and still to be faced with such inaction.
But look, I guess one of the reasons I was keen to have the conversation is I just think it's important not to let these things sort of pass by and just for it to become part of background noise, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Anyway, if people have got thoughts on the conversation or on what they want us to talk about on our Chatteroo, or some people that we could have on as guests on our Chatteroo, they should email us, Jeff, shouldn't they?
Yes, we got the new email address set up.
Do you want to say what it is?
Last week. Yeah. But we've had some already, so
good.
We should chat through some of that next week. But we really want to hear from you, please.
Chatteroo some of that, yes.
It is chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
And it was good to talk about woolly mammoths.
You sort of sometimes bear a resemblance to a woolly mammoth, don't you?
Thank you. You rarely hear of a non-woolly mammoth.
Well, like a mammoth.
Yeah, do we really need woolly in there as a differentiator?
It's an interesting question.
Maybe somebody can answer it. Maybe there are non-woolly mammoths. Or were, I should say. Polyester mammoths.
Nylon mammoths. Yeah. Right.
All right.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.